Yes.
That's what I'm talking about, man. A quick banger of a bump by the hardcore band from Columbus, Ohio, Salt. Probably some of the heaviest music that we've played on the show so far, but not without that rhythm and groove. You know, unless you just really hate all heavy music, I think there's a little bit of that for everyone to enjoy in there. When I first heard Salt a few months ago, I was pretty blown away. You know, it's simple because hardcore isn't meant to be crazy technical, but man, that's everything I want in a hardcore track right there. And I'll be bumping some more of their shit as we get further into the show. And hey, if some hardcore isn't really your bag, there'll be plenty more hip hop. But almost everybody has some sort of place for heavy music, right? I mean, even if it's just going to the gym, running a mile in the morning, something like that. Shout out to Salt. Thanks for tuning in, folks. We're going to continue down our alchemical trek in this episode. We're going to talk about Gautier and Gautier and science. Now, right off the bat, I guess it should be stated, there's a lot of different ways that different scholarly people have pronounced this dude's name over time. I was listening to a Manly P. Hall discussion of the story of Faust. I've heard it over the years, but I listened to it again yesterday, and he called him Gaty, Gaeta, like real bare bones. Never heard anyone say that before. I've also heard, I swear I've heard an R in there before. I'm not sure why. I've heard Gaty. I think the only for sure incorrect way to say it is Gothy. I never heard anyone articulate the H in there. So if you're gonna spitball this guy's name, just remember, definitely don't pronounce the H. But I've heard most people, and I kind of, the first one I ever heard, and the one that always stuck with me, was Gautier. It seems to make the most sense. It makes the most of the actual letters that are in the name in a cogent way. So Gautier in science. But, you know, that's probably not the only way you'll hear these things pronounced elsewhere. And before we get further into that, I guess, you know, if you're interested in some further alchemical discussions in the modern era, you could go check out the prior episodes, obviously. Check out my books, Dive Manual, Empirical Investigations of Mysticism, and Hunt Manual, 21st Century Demonology and Fortiana. Yeah, nothing in particular going on. I'm just continuing to do the usual thing. This is going to be a dense episode today. There's a lot of moving parts. You know, in order to discuss something like Gautier in science, we have to discuss Gautier. We have to discuss his philosophies, and we have to discuss the time period that this was surrounding. And we especially have to discuss Faust a bit, among plenty other things. And then, of course, we have to get into some actual alchemy. It's nice getting into some of this stuff after a true crime bender that we did on the show, getting into some more positive philosophy and psychology. The true crime is certainly not without its merit. And most certainly I'm interested in the true crime aspects, not because of the brutality, but because of the pure extremeness of it. The parts of true crime that fascinate me the most, I wish they hadn't happened, but when I read them, my mind is so blown that they happened that I can't wrap my mind around it, and I need to in some sort of way. And I don't expect to get all the answers, but I try to understand what I can. And when I do understand what I can, it does help me. I think understanding the extremes of the negative and the positive help us carve out, you know, that Buddhist middle path better. And for me, looking into the dark side of things sometimes helps. Or let me phrase it like this. Looking into the dark side of things helps me enjoy the little things in life, but only in moderation. Johann Wolfgang von Gautier was born in 1749, died 1832, and was a prominent scientist in a time where science was still a very, very new philosophical school of thought. And, you know, a Gautierian science is, you know, something that could be compared to a Newtonian science or the Cartesian science. These scientific philosophies, you know, science being this cause and effect study, you know, to boil it down in the most reductionist way, you know, actually looking at something, observing it, and then using control methods to figure out some boilerplate definitions and functions so that we can branch out further. And how we go about that, this is something often people don't think about, but the approach towards science, you know, a scientific philosophy, well, those philosophies can change quite a bit. René Descartes, the famous French philosopher, had an idea that was a bit of a distrust of the human experience and senses. It was a bit the opposite of what we know as empiricism now, which is the idea that all knowledge is derived from the sensory experience. And that's not to say that all knowledge only comes from the sensory experience, like in a solipsistic way, like we are the universe, or like everything outside of us doesn't exist type thing. It's that the human body, the human experience, you know, that each and every one of us is encased in, is our best instrument, and truly in the long run, our only actual instrument for gauging the world around us. And we can use further instruments to specify that, but it's all going to boil down to the human body and mind and psyche that we're encased in. And then for a little bit of further reference, there was Isaac Newton, you know, Newtonian science, which is very much in contrast to Cartesian scientific philosophy. And, you know, it's the idea that physical laws, it's this clockwork sort of observation of the universe, where we can, and it's in, and there's a specific emphasis on experimentation and observation, in order to define these clockwork type laws. Now, Gautier had a very similar approach. Like Newton, he also fancied himself an alchemist. But the big distinction here is that there was less of an emphasis for Gautier on the clockwork structure of the universe and more of an emphasis on what you might call a balance between selflessness in contemplating the phenomenon and the activity of the self in structuring experimental conditions. So what I just said essentially about the human experience being our best instrument, this is something that's largely left out of the scientific model that we have today. In fact, it's entirely left out. And it's considered poor study if the self is injected into scientific work. But this doesn't have to be the case. Gautier argued that in order to accurately gauge any sort of scientific understanding, we have to take into account not only the potential limitations of our own understanding, but we have to actually listen to the experimental conditions and the phenomenon that we are studying and work with it. Now, these are all very vague terms, and it's because we have a whole episode ahead of us. So what does that all mean? We'll get into it. But first, let's talk a little bit more about Johann. Per usual, I've got some notes here. So I will read some here, and I'll have my notes or my sources in the show description. So Gautier was one of the very few figures of Germany's 18th century literary renaissance who were, in the full sense of the term, bourgeois. You know, unlike most of his contemporaries, he had no need, at least in the first half of his life, to seek princely patronage of his writing or employment as an official or an academic. The Frankfurt, Germany, in which he was born, was, and which his social attitudes were formed, was, as it is now, a wealthy commercial and financial center. But it was also virtually a self-governing republic, a city-state within the Holy Roman Empire. The nobility and the grand petty sovereigns who figured so much in Gautier's later life had no part in his early experiences. He was a town child from a rich family in an essentially middle-class world. All right, very nice. His father was a wealthy tailor turned innkeeper. And he was a man of leisure who lived on his inherited fortune and devoted himself, after studying law, to collecting books, paintings, and to the education of his children. Well, that sounds like a pretty good way to be wealthy right there. At least use the money right, right? Teach your children, educate your children, make them cultured instead of just pissing it away. And it's important to emphasize, just if you don't understand, Gautier is just as impactful as, you know, he's tossed up time and time again with people like William Shakespeare, Dante Alighieri, and John Milton, you know, Paradise Lost. So he's thrown up with the great playwrights of all time, specifically alchemist playwrights. You know, William Shakespeare is an enigmatic character, but he was clearly interested in alchemy, so much so that there's, you know, that long-running Masonic, I guess you could call it a conspiracy theory, because I think that would technically be the actual definition. But there's the idea that Sir Francis Bacon, among other people, were like a collection of potentially Masonic writers that were, you know, under the pseudonym William Shakespeare. I don't know if you've heard that before. I'm sure plenty of you have. But anyway, so all very alchemical and classical writers right there. Here's some other interesting bits about Gautier's life. In the 1760s, thereabouts, end of the 1760s, he fell in love with the daughter of an innkeeper. But apparently she preferred someone a little more solid who wasn't a fanciful botanist, alchemist, playwright, and married a lawyer. And this woman definitely seems to be Gautier's muse. It was similar to Beatrice with Dante. Seems to have been something that catalyzed something deep in his psyche. Spearheaded some very alchemical mindsets of union of opposites in terms of the masculine and feminine, the divine masculine and feminine. And I guess, you know, bringing up the muse is a proper time to make this disclaimer. It always has to be said in a conversation about alchemy these days. When we're talking about the divine masculine and feminine, it's important to understand that we're not getting into identity politics here. And what I mean by identity politics is just all of this culture wars stuff. You know, whether you're on the right, you're on the left, this doesn't have to be involved with that shit. And in fact, it really shouldn't be involved with that shit unless understood properly. And the proper context here is this. All right, hear me out. I'm going to get a little bit politically descriptive, but I'm not going to say anything crazy. So just sit tight and let's all get on the same page here. So there's a big debate on what it means to be a man and a woman. Some people say that it's an essence, you know, sexuality is a spirit of being, and that being a man or a woman is that spirit of being. And then there are other people who say No, being a man or a woman is a matter of, to be candid, a dick and or a pussy. So if we can I don't think anyone is arguing that a dick and a pussy do not exist. They're just arguing that the definitions of man and woman, male and female, need to not be tied to the genitalia, which is a radical idea for, the average person. But I can see the merit behind it. If that's the direction that the culture needs to move in, then I don't see a problem with it. It's certainly radical, but it's pretty in line with an alchemical school of thought. I don't really see any overt alchemical tones in the LGBTQ movement at all, but not that there needs to be, but the idea of the masculine and feminine as forms of energy, forces of nature, is something that falls perfectly in line with that. There's masculine and feminine inside of us all, and before it gets too far away from me, the masculine and feminine are symbolic to begin with. Hence the force of nature part that can't be male or female. What we're looking at is positive and negative. Positive and no, not good and evil. That's a whole different discussion. Go two episodes prior because untangling that rat's nest of misunderstanding is a whole different thing. You can go look at the images of God and the devil episodes if you want an untangled perspective on good and evil from this point of view. Positive and negative are active and receptive. Anywhere in nature, we don't have biology as we know it without the seed and the egg in a variety of different capacities. But we see it in plants, we see it in insects, it's everywhere, including humanity. So we don't need to use identity politics or culture wars. We don't even need to relate the masculine and feminine to, a dick and a pussy. So long as we all understand, and as far as I get it, this has never been a dispute that in biology, there, in just in order to continue to further any sort of species, except for the outliers that are asexual and could just reproduce, there has to be an egg and something to fertilize the egg. If you disagree with me on that, I don't know. I don't even know where to begin wrapping my head around what you're talking about, because this is, you don't get alchemy without understanding this, because the action potential and the incubation of that action potential is a metaphor for our thoughts, for our life as we know it, for damn near everything around us. It's how everything happens. It's the formation of life, and the study of it. And that's what alchemy is. But that's it. Again, so as long as we can just understand the action potential and the incubation of the action potential, we can call it whatever we want. Let's all get on the same page here, okay? Alchemy isn't about culture wars. And so this is just me doing my due diligence because I care about alchemy. And now that we all understand that, we can move forward. It's funny because alchemy seems to be the only conversation where botany and sexuality can come up organically and intertwined together without being weird or even period. Where else does a conversation about sex and plants come up? For some further scientific perspective here, Newton's models and Gautier's models are, in some instances, in contrast with each other. Not so much in their overall philosophies. Gautier's is, an empirical process. It's still you know, just as much a hard-nosed science with just more of an existential implication at the starting point. But there's certain things, like for one particular example, Newton's color theory versus Gautier's color theory. In historical retrospect, scientists, you know, Newton's color theory, I'm not an expert in this, but is the sound theory of the electromagnetic color spectrum. Gautier had a slightly varying theory, and it isn't particularly inaccurate if you consider it the color theory model that represents human color perception. So we're looking more, one is looking more inner and one is looking outer. And so throughout it, you could say that Gautier's science is the most philosophical approach to science. There's philosophical in the broadest sense of, like, what is your philosophy of life? You know, however you approach life becomes your philosophy, whether you call it that or not. And then there's textbook philosophy. And when I'm saying Gautier had by far the most emphasis on philosophy, I'm talking like textbook philosophy, the dense stuff. This was at the forefront for him. So, and the idea itself of a Gautier in science is not something that is new to me, but in understanding it as a scientific philosophy, you know, historically juxtaposed to things like Newtonian science and so forth, that aspect of it is a little newer to me. But in terms of Gautier's alchemical processes, and especially his rendition of Faust, as well as his fascinations with botany and color theory, these things are not new. So I'm very familiar with the process at hand, but the context of some of it is new and insightful to me. Because as we'll get into after we develop this scientific model just a bit more, we can see, you know, for better and worse, because these people are flawed characters, and we will certainly get into that. But a lot of Gautier's spirit of science was spearheaded by people like the esotericist Rudolf Steiner, and people today like Rupert Sheldrake. And I think those guys went in some wild directions, both of them, but it'll be interesting to go through the lasting tradition of Gautier sciences. Before we get into that break at the half hour here, let's define this process just a little bit more. Now, in order to understand this in the scientific philosophical context, I read a bit of Steiner's work on Gautier, as well as some other studies that I will link in the show notes here. And so I have a collage of notes here, and I'll give you this. The most basic tenet of Gautier's scientific method is that we enter into the experience of the phenomena itself, remaining with it throughout our research, rather than speculating beyond it or replacing the phenomenon with an abstract concept or mathematical model. By dwelling in the phenomenon itself, Gautier maintained that one could come to see the unity and lawfulness of the natural world. In his scientific studies, he was seeking to explain nature by laws of development lying within nature itself, not external forces located outside of nature. In this sense, Gautier's approach was truly phenomenological. A phenomenological science draws theoretical concepts from the structure of phenomena themselves rather than from the imperceptible reality assumed to be behind them. This approach places emphasis on the scientist's perceptual capacities and underlines the primacy and immediacy of sensory phenomena as reliable sources of true information. Insofar as he makes use of his healthy senses, man himself is the best and most exact scientific instrument possible. We do not need to exclude ourselves of our senses, only our judgment, from the scientific process in order to practice good science. Gautier recognizes this individualization and does not consider it an obstruction to the validity of the science. Rather, it places responsibility on the scientist and allows for the development of the scientist in the process. The practice of the Gautierian way of science is an exercise for scientists as they test and develop their ability to see the unity of nature as it manifests in the multiplicity of its parts. This approach requires the delicate empiricism Gautier calls for in the scientist, that one maintains an inner state of openness and willingness in which the phenomenon may present itself. Gautier did not accept the replacement of personal observation and study with the use of instruments and measuring devices, which tend to substitute the experience of the object under study with a mathematical construct. This replacement may well serve in the accumulation of information, but it does not lead to an understanding of the phenomenon or of how we should interact with it. The fear of subjectivity dissolves through consistent effort and rigorous self-critical methodology from the scientist. Experimentation is not tested against an abstract mathematical expression which replaces the phenomenon, but against the phenomenon itself. All phenomena have a rational conceptual structure. A full understanding of phenomena would bring their rational structure to self-consciousness, which must be the goal of a phenomenological science. A far more difficult task arises when a person's thirst for knowledge kindles in him a desire to view nature's objects in their own right and in relation to one another. On the one hand, he loses the yardstick which came to his aid when he looked at things from the human standpoint, in relation to himself. This yardstick of pleasure and displeasure, attraction and repulsion, help and harm, he must now renounce absolutely. As a neutral, seemingly godlike being, he must seek out and examine what is, not what pleases. Thus, the true botanist must remain unmoved by beauty or utility in a plant. He must explore its formation, its relation to other plants. Like the sun which draws forth every plant and shines on all, he must look upon each plant with the same quiet gaze. He must find the measure for what he learns, the data for judgment, not in himself but in the sphere of what he observes. The Gautierian methodology challenges us to embrace this deeper wholeness of a phenomenon, to see it in relation to the rest of the natural world and to ourselves. This intimacy and ability to see wholeness, the inner organization, becomes especially vital in working harmoniously with landscape as in agriculture. Through an understanding of wholeness, we may deepen our reverence for the natural world and be moved to bring this respect into all of the realms of our lives. And I think that's a nice place to do this little commercial break. After all this quiet, chill consideration of nature, let's jump into a banger of a track by Salt. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen, and everybody else. Buckle the fuck up and stick with me through this commercial break. We'll be right back. Hello? Is this thing on? Okay, please edit this out for me.
But my name is Steve Buscemi, formerly known as Jefferson Tillamook Slinger. As many of you know, I am a big fan of the Highlander movies and television show. But many of you may not know how confusing and fucking stupid that the whole storyline is. And I'm here to tell you, as a public service announcement to all them youngins out there that don't understand the Highlander franchise, it's okay. You're not alone. And if it makes you feel any better, basically the director's cut of the first movie and the TV show are the only things you really need to pay attention to. Everything else is just retconned bullshit. And it's a mockery. So just forget about, you know, the second and third movies and all those Sci-Fi Channel movies. It was all not good. It just served to confuse people, and even the people involved with those projects have pretty much said, don't think of those as an official story, so don't worry, maybe you can rest easy at night. But the fact of the matter is, the Highlander series might be perhaps the biggest botch in all of nerd culture history. Next to things like the movie Jumper with Hayden Christensen. Could have been great. Was not very great. Also, Die Hard was a Christmas movie, and I am a classy movie critic. Oh, God. I am Apex Monsoon, the cosmic ghost pirate. The last quarter of sales have not been too great for my Dolphin Pirate Tarot deck. Not many of you have been interested, and you know, that's fine. I'm brimming with good ideas. I'm a pirate anyway. Arrgh! So, what I've done is, I've created Apex Monsoon's Cosmic Pirate Space Rum. Spiced space rum, matey. That's right, I've taken Caribbean rum, Kirkland Caribbean rum, and I've thrown that pulpary that's sprayed with synthetic cannabinoids that you can get at gas stations where it's not illegal now. And I've got that floating in the Kirkland spiced rum. And I've also thrown a little mini umbrella in there and put a cork on top. And it's my Apex Monsoon Cosmic Pirate Space Rum. Get it now at tippypatson.government/DDU. Arrgh! Do it now! I'm a pirate, matey! Arrgh! Yeah, okay, cool. Hello, everybody. Bloody hell, mate. It's your girlfriend, Silverback Commando, here. You know, I'm still selling the old dolphin glue in there gel, but you know, gotta do a little bit of a PSA here because I do not have enough dolphin grade LSD strips to be supplying every single order of the dolphin glue and air gel with. So if you received an order with the promise of the strip of LSD and you didn't get it, I did not expect so many people to notice, and I just don't have enough to share. So also, I've got to go back to the drawing board a little bit, I think, because I think I might have been giving too many of these dolphins a bit too much of the LSDs. Because one of them recently popped on me like a balloon. Not sure. I'm gonna have to figure that one out a bit. But in the meantime, you can still get the dolphin glue in there gel, for holding on to your toupees or your dentures or making your toys creepy crawl. That's it for now. Take care, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I'm glad to be speaking with you again.
I just finished polishing off a bowl of DMT, and my brain feels like a light bright, Brotendo. Just so you know, Muscle Tornado has heard your requests for DVDs and not VHS tapes of my dolphin safety, no, alligator safety and hook hand combat techniques. But I've sunk all my funds into tapes. I knew that records were coming back, but I thought that tapes would be as well. They're not. But anybody that has Walkmans out there, you can definitely get my hook hand combat alligator safety techniques. I was recently reading online about how alligators communicate through a series of whistles and clicks, and I think I may incorporate that into my next volume edition. But I still can't make DVDs or CDs. I don't even really know how to. But I promise that I will be pressing some vinyl with the next release. This is Muscle Tornado, over and out.
Alchemy, folks. We are talking about Gautier and science, and we're going to jump right back into it. I'm going to put on my glasses here for some of this fine print, and I'm going to read some of this study done by Dana Pauly. You can find this in the show notes. This is a published study done on a phenomenological study of plant metamorphosis. The subtext here is, the following is the part of the segment of a thesis written as a part of the author's work at Prescott College toward a degree in environmental studies with an emphasis in agroecology. All right, so salute to Dana there. I'm going to read a bit of this to help us, as a cherry on top, contextualize what we've talked about a bit. We live in an age of an increasing polarization among theories regarding the nature of life. Some claim that the mysteries of life and the human being will unfold with the deciphering of the genetic code, while others urgently demand that science be morally, socially, and environmentally responsible for its findings and its association with the technological advancements. Quantum physics reminds us there is no true line of separation between the observer and the observed, that the world does not work in linear ways. For even the most determined material scientists, nature is a non-linear dynamic system. The wholeness of nature cannot be found through a dissection of its parts. Do we include this concept of wholeness in our scientific practice? Many scientists and large corporations reduce life to a material commodity as they patent seeds, trademark research laboratory animals, and genetically manipulate plants and animals for herbicide and pest resistance. This approach to the natural world has led to the compartmentalization of the farm, where annual and perennial plant cultivation, forestry, and animal husbandry were once practiced together as a living system. It is this materialistic approach to nature which places more emphasis on quantity, measurement, and isolated environments to explain life rather than on relationships and personal experiences that the poet, playwright, and scientist Johann Wolfgang von Goethe was wary of 200 years ago, almost lost my place. He proposed a participatory methodology for studying and discovering lawfulness in the natural world. The essence of the natural world is the growth and change, constant interaction between both the living and non-living realms. The relationships between various beings in nature are not linear, but reciprocal and simultaneous, generating what has often been referred to as a web of life. One may find deeper meaning in seeing that the very same patterns and processes at work in the natural world are also at work in the individual human being. Gautier states, if we would arrive to some degree as a vital intuition at a vital intuition of nature, we must strive to keep ourselves as flexible and pliable as the example she herself provides. Life and living processes are not linear, but they are directional. This directionality follows patterns that obey the laws of nature. It was through his mission to discover and see the unity and lawfulness of nature, and especially through his observations of plants, that Gautier discovered and developed his theory of metamorphosis. He gave definition and deeper meaning to these laws through his studies in anatomy, botany, zoology, geology, and meteorology. By allowing and training ourselves to become active in our thinking and to grow and change with the phenomena of plants, animals, landscapes, etc., we attempt to understand how the processes of becoming and of dying away are manifested and at work in the natural world and in ourselves. This type of seeing is not meant to replace the conventional scientific method, but to enhance it by exploring phenomena in a different way. Environmental work such as ecological restoration and agriculture, where the human being works in an intimate relationship with the natural world, requires this ability if work is to be appropriate for an extension of the landscape. The most basic tenet of Gautier's scientific method is that we enter into the experience of the phenomenon itself, remaining with it throughout our research, rather than speculating beyond it or replacing the phenomenon with an abstract concept or mathematical model. By dwelling in the phenomena itself, Gautier maintained that one could come to see the unity and lawfulness. In his scientific studies, he was seeking to explain nature by laws of development lying within nature itself, not external forces located outside of it. And I've given this quote before. Gautier was very much inspired by Dante. This is the final quote of Dante's Divine Comedy. Spoiler alert. Here, vigor failed the towering fantasy, but yet the will rolled onward, like a wheel in even motion by the love impelled that moved the sun in heaven and all the stars. And I think a strong takeaway here, and this is why there's such a heavy emphasis on existential philosophy in Gautier's perspective on science, is because the human experience is a force in and of itself. It is an instrument. And in Dante's quote here, it is emphasized that love is a force of nature. The will rolled onward like a wheel in even motion, like basic physics, by the love impelled, by the love that stirs within us, that same love that also is basic physics that moves the sun in heaven and all of the stars. So I think understanding, this is a basic tenet of alchemy. It's the inner and outer, the macrocosm and microcosm. As above, so below, as within, so without. The fractal is a self-contained, individualized piece of the whole that mimics the whole. I'll also say this again. The whole idea of an existentialist approach to science is what I considered, you know, the self-conscious flap of the butterfly wing, not self-conscious, like, oh, should I do this? Oh, like self-aware, I guess you could say. Chaos theory is the basic tenet that theoretically the flap of a butterfly wing could be given enough proper preconditions to create a typhoon halfway around the world. Now, that doesn't mean that it will happen most of the time. That might not happen ever, that particular instance, but it very well could happen theoretically. And imagine if that butterfly became aware of its potential to create a typhoon with that flap of the wing. Imagine what it could do, you know, and knowing that that might be possible, no matter how rare it might happen, that's a powerful thing. That in essence is, I think, the biggest takeaway to this existentialist approach to science, to the alchemical approach to science, to the alchemical approach to life. You know, flap your wings. You know, there's, it doesn't, you know, something might not stick every time, but that's part of the methodology. That's part of the process, especially when it just comes to, you know, speaking outside of science and just comes to making shit happen in your own life. All right. And we're not going to get out of here immediately. Certainly not. We're getting towards the end here, though. And before we get out of here, I want to talk a bit about Steiner, Rudolf Steiner himself. And after that, we'll briefly discuss Rupert Sheldrake, because both of these guys have done a bit to further the Gautierian concepts, but I think it's, you know, with mixed results. So Rudolf Steiner was born in Austria, 1861 to 1925, but he was especially inspired by the old school occultist Helena Blavatsky. Now, if you're not familiar with some of these names, just so you know, in today's esoteric schools of thought, so for those unaware, there's the big four of like old school heavy metal. There's Slayer, Metallica, Megadeth, and Anthrax. I consider the big four of like occult school of thought today, whether you like them or not, it's just a matter of their influence. Aleister Crowley, Rudolf Steiner, Helena Blavatsky, and Manly P. Hall. Blavatsky was a kooky esotericist that had some interesting ideas, fleshed out some old lines of thought, you know, like Kabbalistic tree of life type stuff that is still useful to this day, and also had a lot of wacky stuff that was pretty throwaway. Rudolf Steiner was a student of Blavatsky that really snowballed a lot of his own stuff to a point where I consider him separate from Blavatsky, even though there's definitely a strong follow through there. Crowley, I mean, everyone's got to know about Crowley at this point, right? And Manly P. Hall, if you've listened to this show before, you're well aware of him. He was a Masonic philosopher and scholar. He's the one that I definitely drew the most inspiration from by far, in terms of those big four. You know, I found some Kabbalistic interest in Blavatsky, as I did Crowley. And I thought Crowley's paper on the psychology of hash was cool and some other stuff, but Crowley's got a lot of throwaway stuff as well. I never found anything throwaway with Manly P. Hall. It was always just really scholarly and informative and, you know, empirical. Manly P. Hall had a very Jungian approach and referenced Jung many times. And Steiner was someone that was very alchemical, but there's this solid line. I guess it's just like sort of a religious mentality with esoteric minded people like Steiner and Blavatsky, where they have interesting points, but then they take these, you know, metaphorical, allegorical concepts and really run with them to super literal spots that don't make any sense. And then they really stake a flag in the ground, like this is an important point. And because of those things, I could only take them so seriously, you know. But as a couple examples, for some of the nonsense that they talked about, the biggest one being they have this, they both were obsessed, both Blavatsky and Steiner, with what basically was a softball metaphysical philosophy of eugenics. And there was all this talk about root races and where certain places people came from. And particularly with Steiner, where, and Steiner had a wishy-washy approach to anti-Semitism in this boiling pre-World War II that he lived in. A basic catch-all for his approach to philosophy and science is that Steiner believed that humans once participated more fully in spiritual processes of the world through a dreamlike consciousness, but had since become restricted by their attachment to material things. The renewed perception of spiritual things required training the human consciousness to rise above attention to matter. The ability to achieve this goal by an exercise of the intellect is theoretically innate in everyone. So when it comes to things like that, we have some useful starting points, but and we get things that exist today, like, you know, the Waldorf education system. If you never heard of that, it's a it's a fairly popular alternative school system that essentially, you know, in very literal ways, takes the Gautierian approach to science and places it in a school setting. So it's very existentialist, but it's still very empirical in the sense that we're making sure that a child gets a regular education as well, you know, reading, mathematics, these things, but there's an emphasis on the arts and finding what really speaks to you in your education. And, you know, Steiner spearheaded that. He also spearheaded, like, you know, in the terms of a farm, looking at the farm in a single self-sustaining organ, as a single self-sustaining organism that thrives through biodiversity, the integration of crops and livestock, and the creation of a closed-loop system of fertility. He also brought forth a unique and comprehensive approach to soil, plant, and animal, and human health that recognizes the importance of the healthy interplay of cosmic and earthly influences. He also developed preparations used by biodynamic farmers on the soil, compost, and plants that helped build up the farm's innate immune system. And a lot of Steiner's science is stuff that takes really interesting approaches and has really solid foundations. And then just he just keeps going with it. And there's just a lot of small examples of that without getting into a whole lot of detail. But the scientific community agrees with me, or, you know, I guess if we're talking numbers, I agree with the scientific community. A lot of the science that Steiner talked about is good foundation, weird follow through. So that's an important grain of salt to take with his work. And, I have another bit here to follow up on Steiner's work. It's a bit that I'll have in the show notes. It's a paper written about Rudolf Steiner and the history of the Jewish question, which is a term that was tossed around describing the prejudice and, you know, the whole implication of what the Nazis were doing and what was happening around then. Steiner's published views on Jews were even more self-contradictory than his other statements on various ethnic and racial groups. These contradictions are partly explained by the fact that Steiner's position on the quote-unquote Jewish question shifted significantly over time. In the overall arc of Steiner's intellectual development, his attitude towards Jews moved from an unreflective embrace of anti-Semitic prejudices to public denunciation of the excess of organized anti-Semitism to an elaborate racial theory of cosmic evolution in which anti-Semitic themes played a prominent part. To simplify matters a little, Steiner's changing stance can be divided into three stages: an early phase of cultural anti-Semitism during his pan-German nationalist period, a middle phase of individualist philo-Semitism around the turn of the century, and a later phase of esoteric anti-Semitism during his mature anthroposophist career, the Blavatsky-inspired philosophy, from 1902 onwards. There is undoubtedly a progressive, universalistic, and humanist side to Steiner's teachings, which many commentators take to be emblematic of his doctrine as a whole, even those who are otherwise alert to the pitfalls involved in similar occult philosophies. This perspective misconstrues the distinctive nature of Steiner's racial teachings. Critical review of the textual evidence indicates that it is precisely the apparently progressive, humanist, and universalist elements in anthroposophy that lie at the heart of Steiner's deeply problematic stance towards Judaism and the Jewish people. So this is why, even though Steiner has some very interesting ideas in terms of Gautier and science and, you know, something like Waldorf education, he's not someone that I feel very inspired by, for obvious reasons. Lastly, very briefly, we'll talk about Rupert Sheldrake and the morphic fields, because this is a bit of an extension of Steiner, who was in turn piggybacking off of Gautier. And real quickly, just to encapsulate this a bit, because I think that this is an easy place to take a Gautier in science too, and I think that it's an incorrect place. Rupert Sheldrake is a philosopher and scientist that has popularized this idea of morphic fields. And the morphic field is the idea that nature is bathed in elusive entities that influence the development of form. It's somewhat analogous to electromagnetic fields, although morphic fields would be sources of information rather than energy. this morphic field is coupled with the idea of morphic resonance, a kind of cosmic immaterial memory bank. Morphic resonance stores all kinds of information about form and growth in nature. There would be morphic resonance for snowflakes, for example, and so forth. So morphic resonance is dynamic, and it includes things like, say, a population of laboratory rats that are learning how to escape from the maze. Well, according to Sheldrake, the solution they discover is collectively remembered. Thus, when another population of rats puzzles over the same maze, its individuals will find the way out more quickly through morphic resonance, which they can draw on. And this is basically the 100th monkey theory, which is tenuous at best. It's interesting philosophy at best, but it's not really science, unfortunately, as cool as that would be. And if you look more into the modern day ramifications of Gautier in science, you'll come across Sheldrake's name a bit more. And long story short, I just wanted to address it a bit as a wrap up. I think he has also some interesting points, but I think that the follow through that he has is unnecessary. In many cases, the idea of morphic resonance is a bit in opposition to mimetic theory, which was developed separately from Carl Jung's idea of archetypes, but actually they go together fairly well, the ideas of mimetics and archetypes. I think they go together particularly well, and they make sense together. There's no need for this idea of morphic resonance. Like, there's already enough explanation and understanding. I don't think, and even if there is, you know, the idea of like an information field around us, there's so many information fields to begin with already. So this idea of like a sort of Akashic record that is compelling all of nature to evolve seems, it just seems so high-minded and unnecessary. And I think that we are crossing the wires of philosophy and science and confusing the two a little bit here. And I don't think that's what Gautier would be doing. I think Gautier would not be interested in Rupert Sheldrake today. He'd be interested in the implications of chaos theory. And, you know, the idea of memetics comes directly out of chaos theory and so forth. So those are just some of my modern day cherries on top of the Gautier and scientific philosophy. And as the final takeaway here, I will bring up Faust one more time. And since we have considered the perspectives of other people on Gautier's work, let us consider the perspectives of Gautier's work himself. The reason he's considered one of the greatest playwrights, the story of Faust, which is his rendition, the most popular rendition today of a medieval story of Dr. Faust, Dr. Faustus, as it was originally. And it goes that Dr. Faust was a real guy. He was an alchemist in his own right. And I don't know much about the true history of Dr. Faustus, but as Manly P. Hall describes, he goes into some detail about how, aside from, his doctor practices, he was interested in alchemy, and he was also, he had a pet dog that he was really good at training, and had trained this dog to do all sorts of tricks, and that was part of the reason that people thought he was associating with devils. So the whole motif of Dr. Faust is a doctor who has sold his soul to the devil. And it goes through many renditions. And by the time it comes out of Gautier's mind, it's a lot more esoteric, with commentaries on things like the Book of Job. And this is what Gautier considered his life's work, ultimately. This was his alchemical compendium. And this is something that he worked on for decades, I believe, like most of his adult life. And it is something that cannot be summarized entirely. It just can't be summarized. But if we're breaking it down to its biggest, most basic points, it is the story of the human experience juxtaposed, and human salvation, if you will, juxtaposed between science and spirituality. At the time of the play of Faust becoming popular, even before Gautier, it gained popularity during a time of growing distrust in the church. People, through just being socialized long enough to start to understand things and see discrepancies in the church, were starting to lose some of their faith in the church. You know, the church was talking about spiritual principles that went against some of the basic common knowledge understandings that would grow into science as we know it. And because of this, people were, there was an existential dread that is not uncommon to today's existential dread of the old gods, quote unquote, metaphorically dying out. And what are we left with in terms of what we can feel comfortable believing in? And Gautier was very much inspired by this mindset. It's why he was such a scientific person. And so there's a great merit of given to science in the story, but at the same time, the juxtaposition is tightly woven here, because science is also what robs Faust of his mortality, it's what robs him of his humanity. And through an existential dread of a potentially wasted life full of information but no real life experiences, he summons Mephistopheles, who Gautier couches as an angel in the court of heaven at the beginning of the play, the poem. So in a Job-like setting where God tasks Mephistopheles with basically the concept of being a daemon in the ambiguous sense of the term, for Faust, he grants him this limitless alchemical potential, and Faust becomes this master wizard that he, you know, uses to a lot of corrupt ends. And at the end of it, we find that Faust finally, the only way he saves his own soul is through a final moment of clarity, a genuine understanding of all the ways that he has wronged people. True salvation, not just saying the magical words and then going to heaven, but truly understanding and being remorseful. At that final moment, those feelings, that realization gives Faust a heart attack, but it's also the thing that saved him from hell. So we can't have one without the other, and this shows the multiplicity that exists in Gautier's mind and the, you know, in the alchemist mindset as a whole. Too much spirituality blinds us, too much science robs us, and we probably need a little bit of both. And I, you know, before I go, I'll say a lot of I've thought about this a lot, and I feel that so much of the beginning setting of the play, showing Mephistopheles as an angel and then having him manifest as, for all intents and purposes, as a devil, I think has a lot to do with the Eastern concept of demonology and trauma. The idea that demons and even hell are places that your soul can go to and be trapped in until you realize the root cause of it and take the power away from it. And then you are released. Very different from the, you know, Christianized setting of eternal hell, but no less real. And, you know, one of my favorite examples that's so well played out in visual format of this concept is the movie Jacob's Ladder, not the remake, the original. Trauma and demonology and freeing ourselves from trauma and the cycle of being, of experiencing trauma and then doing it unto others, breaking all of that is the true Eastern sort of takeaway of demonology. And I think that, in the more metaphysical sense, that's a huge takeaway from Faust's, or from Gautier's Faust as well. And, you know, that's about it for now, folks. I hope that was not too windy and twisty and turny and made enough sense. I certainly find the whole concept fascinating. And we'll be coming out next week with some more alchemical material. So if you're digging this, stay tuned. And here's some more salt. We're going out with some real beat down, so get excited. Y'all take it easy out there. Enjoy the small things. We'll see you next week. I'm Anthony Tyler. This is Black Hoodie Alchemy. Get the fuck out of here. So we still fuck.